Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program number 680. This is another interview with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould, the authors of the book Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, published this year in softcover by City Lights Books. Paul and Elizabeth, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
It's great to be here.
Oh. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
By the way, this program is being recorded on July 19th of 2009. I'd like to read a quote, as I mentioned at the start of the broadcast, that actually two programs ago, and For the Record 678, I think in many ways a literary metaphor of your book as a literary cluster bomb. You know, they talk about a bombshell or a blockbuster of a book. A literary cluster bomb, I think, would be a good metaphor, and I'd like to start this interview by reading a bomblet, which in some way explodes in all directions, and I think can, Perhaps mixing a metaphor helped to illuminate the real underbelly or the true events of the Soviet occupation or attempted occupation of Afghanistan in the 1980s. On page 285, you quote Cheryl Bernard, who is not only an analyst for RAND Corporation and an expert on the Middle East, she is the wife of Zalmay Khalilzad, who's a very interesting fellow. Perhaps we can talk more about him during the course of this interview. But in describing what actually took place in Afghanistan during and as a direct result of the trap we set for the Soviets and its aftermath, she writes, or she says, and you quote on page 285, "But the real Afghanistan was lacking one important ingredient." In the words of Cheryl Bernard, a RAND analyst and expert on the Middle East who was married to Zalmay Khalilzad, quote, "In Afghanistan, we made a deliberate choice. At first, everyone thought there's no way to beat the Soviets. So what we have to do now is to throw the worst crazies against them that we can find. And there was a lot of collateral damage. We knew exactly who these people were and what their organizations were like, and we didn't care," she says, again quoting, "Then we allowed them to get rid of, just kill all the moderate leaders. The reason we don't have moderate leaders in Afghanistan today is because we let the nuts kill them all. They killed the leftists, the moderates, the middle of the roaders. They were just eliminated during the 1980s and afterward," unquote. Well, and in your book, you not only explain just exactly what it is that she's talking about, you flesh out the details, but you go into what led into it and what came out of it. Why don't we just briefly sum up some of the key points of our first talk and what exactly she's talking about there when she talks about setting the worst crazies in the world on them?
Well, the name Al-Qaeda itself means the base. And as it was revealed by a British politician a few years back, the base was the database from which the Central Intelligence Agency and MI6, Britain's intelligence agency, drew all the so-called crazies from all over the Muslim world. These were people who in many cases were in jail for having committed all kinds of crimes, not just political crimes, but other crimes as well. They were given a plane ticket in the Kalashnikov to Peshawar, and they were off on the jihad against the Soviet Union.
I think an important point that people need to understand is that when they hear the word Islamist, they tend to assume that there is a religious foundation that somehow is important to what is going on here, when in fact this is really an outright criminal activity. We're talking criminals here. And the fact that they might be Muslim is like, you know, talking about various mobsters around the world, whether he's a Catholic or whether he's a Jew or whether he's, you know, a Hindu. That's not the point. It's whether he is a mobster. And this is what we really need to realize about the Al-Qaeda database and what it was.
In our last interview, we talked about the importation of a group of professional defense intellectuals, a group under the name Team B, this done by the elder George Bush, who presented a radically different and more alarmist picture of the former Soviet Union. We also talked about how Zbigniew Brzezinski, a longtime professional Cold Warrior and part of the Eastern European political contingent overlapping the Third Reich that's guided an awful lot of American foreign policy for the better part of the last 100 years. And we spoke about how basically it wasn't the world-gobbling Soviet monster that stampeded into Afghanistan as part of the grand strategy of engulfing the Middle East, but rather they were deliberately lured into a trap. And one of my favorite sayings is an old Turkish proverb that says, he who tells the truth gets chased out of 9 villages. And during the closing section of our last interview, you talked about basically how you were chased out of a number of different suburbs of what McLuhan referred to as the electronic village in your attempt at telling people what was really going on, including a proposed Soviet withdrawal under Mr. Andropov. Why don't we I know that's a tall glass of water for one sitting. Why don't we try to resume the story at that point, the narrative of that point, and shed light on what exactly Ms. Khalilzad is talking about, what took place in Afghanistan during the 1980s when we were liberating it from Soviet oppression, unquote.
We went to Afghanistan in 1981 for CBS News, came back with a story, all these tapes, interviews with Barbara Kamal, who was the president of Afghanistan at the time, presented them, laid them at the feet of CBS News, and CBS News said, that's not the story. The story is Russians in Afghanistan. There's not much there. I said, well, this is what is going on in Afghanistan. This is a very complicated story. You've got women's rights issues. You've got rebels coming in over the mountains, blowing up power lines and setting mines in villages. And I said, and the local people are trying to defend themselves against this invasion. And the Barbara Kamal, the so-called Soviet-installed president of Afghanistan, stated clearly. He said the Soviet troops will go home if the United States will stop supporting the insurgency from Pakistan. It was that clear. It was very simple. Well, the guy at CBS News said, I didn't read that story in the New York Times. Then we went back in 1983 in order to hold them to their word.
When we took Roger Fisher from the Harvard Negotiation Project, we went out of our way to try to really bring what we consider to be an internationally recognized negotiator who was respected by, you know, all kinds of international entities, including the United Nations, and certainly in terms of the government that, you know, of the Soviet Union. He went and spoke before we even brought him there. He spoke with all of the various important parties, the Pakistanis, the Soviets. We get to Afghanistan, and Roger comes back from meeting with the Soviet expert, and he's absolutely shocked. He said they are desperate to get out. They really want to get out. He basically told me, he said, we make mistakes, Roger, but, you know, we have to get out of Afghanistan and leave.
We make mistakes, Roger, but we're not stupid. You know,
yeah.
You go back to the United States, you tell them back in the United States that, you know, you just give us a 6-month grace period to save face, we'll back out of here, and then we'll let the Afghans fix this problem for themselves.
But once again, he was referring to, again, the insurgency is the key to understanding how the Soviets were actually kept in Afghanistan. They were basically there to support the government's war against the insurgents. Now, there were definitely a lot of confusion going on inside Afghanistan, too, and that doesn't, you know, that's not the, there's no question that there's a complexity there. But in terms of the actual stated purpose for the Soviets being present in Afghanistan by the Afghan government, by Barbara Kamal, and by the Soviets, that was it, okay? Take that back. Get it on to Nightline with Ted Koppel. And basically, the story is presented in such a manner that Roger really ends up having to defend, effectively, the possibility that they might leave, when in fact the whole point of the discussion was to say it should at least be attempted. So the way in which the story was framed left the audience saying, well, there's no reason to follow this up. That's the feeling you got from watching this Nightline. And this is the kind of attitude that we, in 1983, we were really very curious. President Carter had labeled this, when the Soviets crossed into Afghanistan, the greatest threat to peace since the Second World War. We wondered, well, if it's the greatest threat when they crossed, wouldn't it be the greatest relief if they left? It became very obvious at that point to us that there was something about keeping the Soviets there that was very much really the operating agenda. And then you end up in 1984 with Charlie Wilson really getting the whole financing of the Mujahideen in high gear. Well, needless to say, the increased financing to the Mujahideen did exactly the opposite. It actually increased the insurgency. So therefore, the effect of Charlie Wilson's whole operation was to keep the Soviets bogged down effectively in Afghanistan for another 6 years before they left actually of their own volition. And we now know, since they dissolved in 1991, they probably left more because they were internally in such a crisis.
One of the things that people have become familiar with in the wake of Afghanistan are some of the, not Afghanistan, excuse me, the Iraq war, are some of the private national security outfits, which are assuming an increasingly larger role on the American and world national security stages. Probably the best known of those are Blackwater and Titan. In talking about the development of the circumstances which basically lured the former Soviet Union into the Afghan trap and subsequently kept the water boiling, so to speak, again to mix a metaphor, and particularly kept the heat up on the domestic journalistic slash propaganda front. You talk about a number of private outfits overlapping intelligence services of various countries, including this one. I'd like to go through some of those. The one that we have had some discussion of before on these networks, other than the Enterprise, that is the Safari Club. Tell us about the Safari Club.
Well, back in the 1970s, it became very difficult for the Central Intelligence Agency to operate out in the open. What had happened was is that they were caught. There was a thing called the Church Committee hearings, where the CIA was brought up on all these basically issues that they had been doing from the 1950s and 1960s, overthrowing countries, overthrowing governments, and doing all kinds of illegal things that they were not chartered to do without any oversight whatsoever. And so they got into a lot of trouble. So what happened in the mid-1970s, you had a couple of things happening. The end of the Vietnam War, which was devastating to the military-industrial complex as well as the Pentagon and the authority. And you had these Church Committee hearings, which as far as the intelligence community and the military was concerned, were undermining the nature of what they got to do. They needed and wanted the ability to operate in secret without really much oversight whatsoever. So what started to happen was is that it became so embarrassing for the U.S. government to do these things. They started outsourcing their intelligence work. And one of the ways in which they did that was this group called the Safari Club. Now, this was begun by a number of Middle East security agencies. I think probably the Saudis were probably the most instrumental in this, Saudi intelligence. And what they did was they gathered together the Egyptians and Gaddafi's people in Libya, Saddam Hussein's people in Iraq, and the remnants of the Shah of Iran, Savak, and they put them together into kind of an ad hoc group that would go off and do things that were basically advantageous to the United States, but the United States could step back and, as they say, have credible deniability. The United States could step back and say, we didn't initiate this. And the truth is that the United States may not have initiated it, but it may have been taken on as something that was just basically someone in the field said, gee, it would be great if so-and-so wasn't here any longer. And the Safari Club would organize around this sort of thing. Now, the French intelligence, Alexandre de Maranchet, was one of the people involved in this. And he was the guy who came up with the idea of using the opium in Afghanistan to hook Russian troops. He's credited with that early on in the 1980s. But there is a lot of evidence to indicate that that the entire drug operation moved when the United States was in Southeast Asia. There was a huge opportunity for these off-the-books organizations, privatized groups, in order to get involved in this. I mean, using the U.S. military as a cover, which was very easy to do. I mean, the whole situation was so out of control by 1974 and 1975 that I don't think Washington had any idea in terms of what was actually happening in the field.
I mean, we ended up actually getting a contact from the London Bureau of NBC.
NBC News.
This would have been, you know, like 83, maybe?
It was later than that.
84?
It was probably like 84, 85,
okay.
Yeah.
Basically, the person called us and said, we'd like any information you have on the drugs that are coming out of Afghanistan. There's so many drugs pouring into Europe and the United States. We heard stories about drugs arriving in Boston, where we live, that were marked, for the Mujahideen. It was that overt.
Right. This particular call came from a guy in London, and he said, that London police had just arrested a bunch of guys, he said, with bricks of hashish that was stamped for the freedom fighters on it with a Kalashnikov.
There was actually a San Francisco Chronicle, I believe it was, story about, again, bricks of hashish that were turning up in the Bay Area with,
yes,
with an emblem of a Kalashnikov and also the
you
logo.
You mentioned that last time, right.
Smoke Russia Away. And this was actually carried in the Chronicle. And this presumably was going to enable the successors to the Summer of Love to do their bit in the Cold War. But a fair amount of that, some of that has come to light concerning complicity in the narcotics traffic. There are other networks that you talk about that we've never heard of, at least the listeners of this program have never heard about. You mentioned Alexandre de Meranger. How about Le Cercle?
Well, you know, this is something that goes back to probably the French Resistance during World War II, but there are also connections that this was an organization that was formed. There was it's interesting. The Cirque was a club that was very popular, and James Bond is even mentioned. If you go and out and get rent the DVD for some of the original James Bond films, you've got all these guys from British intelligence, and they're all meeting at this place, this club called the Cirque. And this is all very much an aspect of it. You've got the French intelligence, and you've got MI6, British intelligence involved in this. And they're cooking up all of these things that really is outside and off the books, away from the American experience entirely. So they're really in a position with groups like this, to be able to manufacture events in the field, especially through other groups, let's say interlocking groups like the Safari Club. They're able to actually help create events in the field that the United States then has to react to. And that's very much what led up to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. There were all kinds of things going on in Afghanistan and in Pakistan and on the Chinese border, with the Chinese as an example. And what they were doing was, you had remnants of SAVAK, you had the Cirque, you had these individuals who were operating pretty much freewheeling throughout this area and setting up this situation by drug dealing. There's some implications that what was going on with the leader of Afghanistan, as an example, in 1977, 1978, 1979. Hafizullah Amin was very much involved with making his own way financially. I mean, if you look at, apparently, you can read the Russian documents on the Cold War History Project at Princeton, and you can read the documents that were coming out of the what the Russians were saying to them, to each other in the Kremlin, about what was going on in Afghanistan, and them scratching their heads trying to figure out what was going on. Apparently, at one point, Hafizullah Amin asked one of these Soviet advisors whether he could take all the money that was in a bank account and move it to his own private bank account. I mean, it was that obvious about, in terms of what was going on in Afghanistan prior to the Soviet invasion. The Soviets are sitting in the Politburo, and Dropov and all of these people, Brezhnev and Kosygin, they're scratching their heads. Kosygin says at one point, he says, this looks like a detective novel. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. The Soviets were so, out to lunch in terms of what was really going on, and they were being played by MI6, by the Cirque, and by this group of the group of ad hoc agencies.
Well, apparently, Amin apparently admitted to a KGB agent that he was taking money from the CIA, but he presented it that he was playing everybody, and he was just playing along.
He was confronted by the KGB at one point in 1979, and they said, "We know you're taking money from the CIA, and we know you've been seen with these people." And he goes, "Oh, I'm just playing around with them." So, I mean, this is the kind of thing that was going on during that time period. It was absolutely, it was quite bizarre. And the United States, of course, was just simply, you read Cheryl Bernard's quote. I mean, the United States basically said, look, they backed off. I mean, until the summer of 1979, actually it was earlier in 1979 that the United States actively began supporting these radical Islamists. When Zbigniew Brzezinski took over the Directorate of Operations at the National Security Council Stansfield, not from Stansfield Turner, from the State Department, from Cyrus Vance at that point. He really had control of the action arm of the CIA, and he could pretty much do whatever he wanted to do.
It's funny because
one of the things the CIA has been credited with, for instance, is working in tandem with Pakistan to create the Taliban, which a lot of people probably would be surprised to learn. But this is the kind of thing that was, you know, that now is talked about, but is not really completely understood. I mean, I have a quote here from, this was a conversation that Selig Harrison had with General Zia, you know, in the 1980s when he was still running Pakistan, needless to say, when he was still alive, talking about General Zia spoke, this is the quote from Harrison, General Zia spoke to me about expanding Pakistan's sphere of influence to control Afghanistan, then Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, and then Iran and Turkey, Harrison said. That design continues. General Mohammad Aziz, who was involved in that Zia plan, has been elevated now to a key position by Chief Executive General Pervez Musharraf. So this idea of what was going on when all the money was being funneled through Pakistan, that there were plans afoot through Pakistan that clearly had to do with these intelligence operations connecting to other intelligence operations in Europe and, you know, continuing to grow.
And of course, what the center of the operations for this was the Bank of Credit Commerce International, the BCCI. And what that was doing was that was based out of London. That was MI6's idea. And what they were doing was they acted as the exchange for the Saudis, for the Saudi intelligence, for CIA, for MI6, for French intelligence. They acted as an off-the-books agency, and what they did was they banked the money. They were the ones who were responsible for the drugs and the drug trade and privatizing the drug trade and the weapons trade, which got so out of control that now we know that 93% of the world's heroin comes out of this part of the world, and nobody, for some strange reason, nobody can seem to do anything about it.
Well, it's interesting, too, when you consider the fact that when President Carter left office, he became a spokesman for BCCI. And so when you really begin to look at the lineage of Carter being the one who inaugurated this plan with Brzezinski that actually triggered the Soviets to enter Afghanistan, that then created the process that allowed the Reagan-era arms buildup that took over for the 80s to just sail through with no questions asked for the entire decade. It literally was they got anything they wanted and more.
And what's interesting too about it is that a lot of the aid agencies that suddenly appeared to help the poor Afghan refugees in 1981, 1982, that grew up out of this were all part of the CERC. They were all coordinated out of London. There were a bunch of people that were there.
One more before we sort of take a look at some of the ramifications of this privatization of intelligence and foreign policy. One individual player I had not heard of before reading the book, and that is, I believe it's I-6, another derivative of British intelligence. Tell us about I-6, and then let's talk about what happens when you sort of create foreign policy and intelligence tranches, so to speak, which is kind of what they're talking about here.
MI6 is the foreign intelligence operation of British government. They're
right.
Our form of central intelligence.
Right.
As opposed to MI5, which is the FBI. That's their internal security structure. MI6 has got its fingers in a lot. You know, you've got to look back, I suppose. You have to look back to the origins of intelligence operations.
Paul, I just wanted to butt in very briefly. What I was really talking about was I-6. I think it's something like the Sixth International. It was a British intelligence operative who was talking about I-6. As opposed to MI-6. Or was it L-6? Did I misread it?
No, it's the International. It's
right.
I-6.
Right.
It's the Fifth International.
Well, yeah, and then a British intelligence wag, I guess, or a guy, an operative with a bad sense of humor, called this particular private outfit, I believe, I-6, and this was one of the networks that was working with these other players that we've already enumerated.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is that this was a breakdown of the way in which a lot of the people who had come out of the Bolshevik Revolution. This is what's so interesting about the intelligence communities and the war that we've been fighting in the West against the so-called Soviet Union was that you had this thing called the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution. And, of course, you had guys like Lenin who were living in New York City, Lenin and Trotsky. Trotsky is an example, who were living in New York City during that time period, who were basically sent back by funding from bankers in the United States to go back to the Soviet Union and help them form a government. And so you've got this kind of intrigue that goes back to the prior to World War I, the development of communism. And of course, you've got state communism going on in the Soviet Union between Lenin and Trotsky. And what happens is that over time, Trotsky, who was very much integral in terms of forming this thing, winds up coming up against Stalin. Stalin is a Russian nationalist. He's actually from Georgia, but he turns out to be a nationalist. And he believes, as opposed to spreading communism around the world, what he's going to do is he's basically going to, to use it to reestablish the Russian Empire. Okay?
I mean, if the pan-Islamist really would be much more in line with Trotsky, for instance, in terms of that philosophy, worldwide coverage.
Right? One of the things that we do in the book is that we show the evolution of the Trotskyite thinking. Trotsky winds up being expelled from the Soviet Union. He winds up going to Mexico, but he winds up really inspiring a lot of Western intellectuals who believe that the so-called communist revolution, which was spelled out in their International, had gone wrong. That Stalin had got it all wrong. That Stalin's followers were brutal. That this was not really communism, and that the Trotskyites were really going to spread this international communism. So what happens is that you've got this guy named James Burnham, who is kind of he embodies the Western idea. You know, he's educated, in the best British schools. He's involved in the United States. He's upper class American, wealthy, involves himself with Trotsky, becomes Trotsky's secretary actually. And they create this kind of hybridized version of this new way, the managerial society. Burnham kind of invents this thing called the managerial society. And what happens is that over time, Trotsky's whole idea for communism and all these guys who were Trotskyites originally back in the 1930s and 40s, they move from spreading international communism to spreading international capitalism. So it kind of grafts itself very oddly into this kind of Frankenstein monster of this Trotskyite version of communism into free market capitalism. And that occurs during the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. I mean, in a lot of ways, that was what the whole McCarthy era was all about. There were a lot of communists who were involved in this process, but they had been transformed to capitalists. So the religion became, instead of communism, became world capitalism. And they were very successful at doing that. And these were the people who were behind the neoconservatives. A lot of the origins of the neoconservatives, as an example. Irving Kristol is an example, and Wallstetter. All these guys who came out of this era of the 30s and 40s ideologically transformed as they went to work for the United States government.
You know, you might as well consider what was going on in the Soviet Union was more effectively state capitalism. And what we have in this country is basically corporate capitalism. So that's all that the switch was when they went from being Trotskyites that were, supporting international communism, and then they came in supporting international, capitalism. That was really the shift.
We're almost out of time on this side. One thought that comes to mind, and I'd like to explore some of the outgrowths of turning over national and intelligence policy to groups that are, although they overlap the public establishment, they're actually private groups. I was struck by the account of Hafizullah Amin being complicit with some of the CIA and Western intelligence drug traffic. I guess for that Marxist regime, at least, opium had become the religion of the people under the circumstances. So that... It was a bit of a switch on the usual ideological orientation. Your website, on which people can get Invisible History.
InvisibleHistory.com. That's what it is.
All righty. Afghanistan's Untold Story, full title, Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, co-authored by Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. Those authors are my guests, and we're going to be resuming with this discussion inside, too. And we're going to talk a little bit about who's actually been carrying the flag and executing things in the name of the American people, and executing, I guess, in these circumstances should be used advisedly. For Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould, this is Dave Emery saying this This is the conclusion of side one of For the Record program number 680. This has been recorded on July 19th of 2009. For Paul and Elizabeth, thanks for listening.